This is Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories. I'm Sarah Reith, and it's June 13th, 2018.
My name is Anne Scirocco.
Where were you when you decided to come into the country and do a Back to the Land trip?
Well, we were living in Mill Valley. Somebody came up north for, I think they went to Crabtree Hot Springs, as a matter of fact, and on the way back picked up one of those newspaper flyers that gets stuffed in your mailbox and saw someone was trying to sell this piece of property in the Mendocino National Forest. And that's how we ended up there. We bought that property.
How far away is that from a town?
It was 45 minutes in second gear and about 2,000 feet elevation. So there was a Japanese couple and my family and an American couple from Mill Valley who had two children and someone else who I can't remember. And I
So what were you expecting when you moved into the forest?
Oh, I don't know. I'd had this camping experience when I lived in New York City. So I lived in Alphabet City in New York City. There were no trees, you know, it was just like concrete and buildings, six-story buildings. And I went with some friends up to Bear Mountain State Park and camped. And then Monday morning, we got up really early and we broke camp and we went to work. And I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do. So it just seemed to evolve. It took about 8-9 years. It just evolved. So I just wanted to be camping. And so that's what I did for 16 years.
What kind of work did you do before you went camping?
Well, I worked for a publisher and I worked for a sewing pattern company. And I did a bunch of temp work. And I just, you know, New York City wasn't really the thing for me. Then I moved to Boston and I got almost finished a master's in education, but didn't like practice teaching, so I decided I wasn't going to do that. And I did some work for the county, work for the city of Boston for a while, just a bunch of things.
So what were some of your first impressions when you moved into the forest?
I don't know. I 3 weeks later, I had a baby. I didn't have time for impressions. So we were happy that the rattlesnakes didn't come through the yurt.
So you were 8.5 months pregnant when you moved into the forest?
I was.
Did you have a home birth?
I did. It was great.
With a midwife or your husband attending? Or how did
the mountain was a psychiatrist. So he was, you know, he was a doctor. And so he was marginally helpful. I mean, the most helpful thing he did for me was say, around midnight, say, this baby is not going to be born until morning. And I thought, I am not doing this all night. So my attitude changed from, oh, this hurts, to, come on, baby. And then it was an hour and a half later he was born. So, you know, it's like, it just, attitude was everything.
Was that the only home birth you had?
No, I had two more.
So what was that like, being pregnant out in the forest?
Just being pregnant, you know, it's like you keep doing the same things. You keep cooking, washing, you know, carrying water. I don't like to carry water, but you do it, you know, garden, get firewood, you know. I never had a thing about, you know, I have to have this kind of food. That seemed irrelevant to me. That never came up for me. I know for many women, they have food urges, and I've got to have pickles and ice cream or whatever, but that wasn't that my experience.
Did you have any kind of prenatal care or just... So you said that you had a garden and you built yurts. Did you already have building skills?
We made canvas yurts. We made those before we went up. And I have a little teeny Singer sewing machine, and we did half the sewing on that. So we made three of them at one time. And then went up and put them up. So when my older son was born, we barely had wall. I mean, the walls were up and we put the roof up, but I don't think we put up the walls yet. But it was cool. I mean, comfortably cool. You know, the breeze come. We're on a hillside, and in the evening the breeze is coming up, so it was actually lovely.
What kind of housing and shelter situation did you have to come up with when it got cold?
We stayed in the yurt. So at first we didn't have a wood stove, and that you know, my husband had lived in a teepee in the Sierras, so he was used to that. But you can control rain better in a teepee than you can in a yurt. So then we bought three wood stoves from a guy in Willits named Kirk. I don't even know what his first. I still have that stove in the mountains. It says Kirk on it. He put his name on it for us. These wonderful little airtight stoves, and then you know you do with a stove. And then we also used a Japanese country technology called a kotatsu, which is you take embers out of the fire and put them into a clay pot. Well, so we were on a dirt floor. So we dug a hole in the middle of the dirt floor and had a little table over that. And you could sit on the floor at that table and put your feet down in the bottom. And in the middle was a clay pot, and it was filled with embers. And then over the table, you put a quilt and then a tabletop on top of that. And keeps you really warm. I have one now. It's electric now, but it's the same thing. It's very popular in Japan. The old style was dug in with charcoal or embers or cinders, whatever.
How did you get the idea to do that?
You know, they're all over in Japan. Everybody in Japan, I don't know anymore. They didn't used to have central heating, so everybody had now an electric kotatsu. But if you went to a countryside, to an old farmhouse, that's what they were doing. That's how they stayed warm.
Have you been to Japan? Is that where you learned?
Oh, no, my husband knew about it, so I didn't. He was Japanese, so I didn't need to learn about it. But, yeah, that's where I first said, oh, this is really great. I like this. There's lots of jokes about how if you go into the kotatsu, you never come out. Too comfortable.
How long did your yurts last?
They were still there, and so we were there for 16 years. The roof was okay, but we painted the roof. We put house paint on the roof because it leaked. It was supposed to be water resistant. Not so much. And then we realized that if we weren't going to move it, we could just paint it.
So what were some other homesteading skills that you had to learn or figure out?
I don't know about figure out. I mean, I had to learn how to cook on charcoal and on wood. I'd never done that before. And wood is, well, it's messy, but it's pretty easy. But, you know, I got pretty good at cooking on charcoal. And the Kirk stove, the way it was designed, you could put a whole turkey in there overnight. And then in the middle of the night, if you took it out and added some more cinders, we'd save all our embers in a closed pot on bricks, not on, if you put that closed pot on wood, you'll start a fire and burn your house down. We would save all our cinders or embers until they were cinders. And then if you needed to restoke your fire, you just threw them in. Then we had a blowing stick to blow air on it to heat it up faster. We incorporated a lot of Japanese traditional technology. And it was a great lifestyle. I really loved it.
So did you get the ideas from your husband and the Japanese couple that was on the property with you?
Well, they didn't stay very long. They decided that they had other things they wanted to do. So they went back and he became a millionaire. So, they had other things to do. But other people came. So we had a lot of people came to visit us from Japan and other places. And they would bring ideas. So we didn't really have a really good way to bathe for a while. And then a new friend showed up from Japan and said, whoa, you just put a 55-gallon drum on a fire and heat it up, and it's fabulous. You know, you're in water up to your neck. It's hot. There's a wooden rack under your feet. You don't burn your feet. You can control the temperature by adding more wood or adding cold water. Night sky.
What about figuring out how to feed yourselves?
Well, you know, we shopped at the co-op. We were members of the co-op from almost, I don't know at the beginning because I don't know when they started, but from 1979. And so you'd get a 50-pound bag of rice and a 50-pound bag of flour, and you get salt, and you get a 25-pound bag of beans, and then you learn how to do stuff. You learn how to make tempeh, and you learn how to make tofu, and you learn how to make miso. And we didn't get a whole lot. I'd always say I need a box of raisins, but I was the only sugarholic in the family. So you could make bread, and you could cook rice, and there was garden in the is easy. Winter gardens were fabulous. You know, you'd start them mostly in August. And then, you know, you had big daikon, and if there was snow, that they'd be protected and they wouldn't freeze, and you just pop them out. We buy potatoes and onions, too, because we had very rocky. We're on a slope, so we had a lot of very rocky soil. All our topsoil was down in Upper Lake.
So what about livestock or chickens?
We had chickens. My younger son particularly loved his, what do you call them, chicken lumps or something like that, his lumpies. we didn't eat them. We ate their eggs, but we didn't eat the chickens.
So what about educating kids? How'd you raise your kids so far away from town?
Oh, that was my job. We homeschooled until my older boy was 16, and then he wanted to go to regular school. And it was getting too much for me because I had somebody in high school, somebody in middle school, and somebody in elementary school who didn't really want to read. It was getting really complicated for me. So, it was kind of hard to find materials at that point. You know, one time I tried to buy curriculum from somebody, and I forget how much money it cost. And I got this thing, it's like four books. I said, I don't think so. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not getting any benefit from this. And then we found a local school district that would loan us books.
It was a little bit tricky to get the, and what are they supposed to be learning? I had no idea. So we just kind of faked it. Learn how to read. Here's some math. You know, my older son was, he never learned algebra because I don't remember algebra. And, but he learned, he was really good at geometry because of somebody lived there with us for a while who had been a surveyor, and he taught him geometry, practical geometry, not writing theorems. A lot of what would happen is that different people would live there and teach the kids different things too. So in addition to my trying to fill in the blanks, and they love to read, so they were just voracious readers.
Do you remember how they amused themselves?
Oh God, yeah, they just went. They went off, they just leave, you know, and go do whatever they were going to do. They like to play Othello. It's a Japanese board game they like to play, but and do puzzles. But mostly, they were just out eating germs, you know? In the dirt, dirty children running around barefoot and crazy and wild. And my daughter was saying that she and her older brother had made a whole, sounds like it was so, oh my God, dangerous. But they'd made all, on the hillside above us, there was a lot of brush land, and they'd made all these tunnels and secret getaways in the brush land. I have no idea.
You said that a lot of people would come and teach kids how to do anything. Was there a sense of community among the people who were sharing the experience with you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at different times there were, sometimes just my family was there. Sometimes there were four families there. It just kept changing. People would come for a while and then they'd say, I don't know, maybe this isn't what I want to do. Maybe this is for later or whatever, you know. So yeah, everybody brought different skills to the table.
What were your interactions like with the people who were already in the community, like in the town? Did you associate with people who already lived there?
I didn't go to town very much. So lots of time, especially when we were first there, we had one old truck and there just wasn't much room for people to travel together. So I didn't have a whole lot of contact with town with people who lived in town. But I'd hear the rumors later, you know, people would say, oh, are you the people who have the farm in the mountains? She's got a farm, we got four chickens. He's got a farm. No. Oh, we want to bring our nursery school up to visit your farm. We don't have a farm. No. And the stories about that, we hear the stories about the hippies in the mountains, you know, the crazy stories. Are they talking about us? We're just living up here, you know. It's like, it was very funny. There was nobody else living around us. It was very different from the Greenfield feeling where there's lots of people living, you know, doing their thing close by. There was nobody. There were maybe Cobb Mountain had intentional communities, but they tended to be spiritual. Yeah, we'd have Rajneeshis come by too. Good Lord. not him himself, but his people, you know, they're just orange. Anyway, there were other spiritual communities on Cobb, but they weren't around us. There was nobody else up there.
So why did you eventually come back to town?
My older son wanted to go to school. After the Kobe earthquake, he got an airplane ticket and went to Kobe to help. He was 17 then. And he said, well, I'll come back if I can go to school. And I kind of wanted him to come back. I thought that would be a good idea.
Is there a particular memory of that time that's especially emblematic of the experience for you?
No, but I can say that I have lines now that I draw in terms of living. If I were go back and live out in the countryside, way out in the mountains again, that I want the water to run in and I want it to run out. I can take the temperature, but I don't want to carry water in or I don't want to carry water out. And I want one light. Because if you hear some crazy loud noise at night and you wonder what it is, you really want to be able to flip one switch and not have to look around for a lighter to light kerosene or to do some kind of other, you know, like a process just to get some light to see what's going on, particularly if you have babies. I mean, it's just like one light. Saying that, we spent 6 months in Big Mountain in 1986, so we didn't have one light there. And the water didn't run out and didn't run and run out, but hey, but you know, that was like different.
Was that was a separate living arrangement?
1986, Big Mountain, you know, Big Mountain resistance was being pressured by the federal government. I don't know if you know this history, but anyway. So in 1972 or so, the federal government decided that some of the Navajo land really belonged to the Hopis.
So they made a, kind of an arbitrary, even though the Hopis had always lived in the mesas, had never lived out there, they made this kind of arbitrary line, and they said that anybody who was Navajo, which is really should be called Diné, had to move. So there was a big resistance, particularly from older Diné women. And they said, we're not moving. This is our ancestors. We've lived here. Our ancestors lived here. Our parents lived here. Our families lived here. We're not moving. And then the government started pressuring them and continues to pressure them now. So taking their sheep, putting up fences where the fences didn't belong, just trying to harass them out of there. And so we went in 86 because in 86 the government was talking about they were going to come in with the military and physically move people off the land. So we went just to be observers. And we set up, we had camp, water did not run in. In fact, we did that. We had to go with 55-gallon drums way over there and fill up the drums. And then the elder we lived near, she was brilliant. She had to be in her 50s at least, or 60s. And she could get, on her lonesome, she could move a 55-gallon drum full of water from the back of the pickup, from the front of the pickup bed to the back all by herself. I don't know how she did it. And so anyway, we stayed there and just kind of observed.
What did you see?
Oh God, I loved it there. It was really marvelous. I mean, it's really desert. And the Diné people that live on the land, they just know everything. I mean, you couldn't sneak around on these people if you wanted to, you know, because they were really good trackers. They were really good farmers. They were really smart, really dedicated to living where they were living. So it was quite a fun experience. We set up a little peace cafe. So I made coffee for so many people. That was fun. And my younger son was born there. Yeah.
Did you have any memorable encounters with wildlife while you were living on the land?
Well, not face to face. I mean, we saw the big prints of a mountain lion that went by, but it didn't come bother us. And then our friends who had across the creek had another yurt, and they'd gone to town, and there was water running in the creek, so we shouldn't have been able to hear anything. We hear all this noise over there, and it's dark, and I think, no, I'm not going to go check. No, it's okay. I'll check later. And a bear had come through their yurt, kind of busted. So what bears do is they come through one side, and then they go straight through. They don't go back out the day they came in. And they grabbed up, he'd been drying some trout that he caught, and they grabbed up the trout, ate the trout, and then grabbed up a big bag of garbage and somehow managed to carry this plastic garbage bag, like, you know, regular garbage bag, way into the... He found the garbage bag later, torn up, but it was about a quarter of a mile away from his house. So we still haven't figured out how the bear managed to move it that far up this steep hill without tearing the bag. But over his shoulder, on the back feet, I don't know. But mostly, no, we didn't, you know, we saw bear on the road sometimes when we come home. But mostly, besides, you know, having to fight off the deer from our garden, we didn't really. There's no pigs up there, so we have to think about that.
So you were talking earlier about going to Big Mountain to be observers and that you were involved with the Diné people. And I'm wondering if there was a sense of political activism that led to your being back to the Landers.
No, I don't think so. I think I just wanted to live in the woods. I just like the woods, so I think so. Oh, Big Mountain was interesting for me because the Diné people didn't trust me because I'm white. And it's a really, I think, an excellent experience for a white American to have an experience where you're dealing with a lot of prejudice based on the color of your skin, because it really opens your eyes to what that feels like and how, I don't know, unfair. I mean, it seemed fair to me because every, you know, people are doing that to them. You know, why shouldn't it happen to me? But that was a really a unique experience for me. Whereas my husband was Japanese. They loved him. They kept calling him the Chinaman, but you know, they were a little yeah, you know, but he was fine, but I was suspect, always suspect. No, I let her, you know. He could go to a peyote meeting, but I was not allowed. Which is okay. That's just an example. That didn't really make any difference. But I felt that a lot, you know, that the elders would talk to him, but they, another white person. They don't trust white people. Why should they?
What was your favorite part of the whole Back to the Land experience?
Oh, geez, I don't know. I learned so much up there. It was really fun. I mean, my Japanese language is still really terrible. I mean, at some point, I could really follow a conversation, but I couldn't really speak. I could never get my brain around the syntax. But I learned a lot of stuff that was really fun for me. So I liked it all. You know, I didn't care if I was, you know, pulling firewood down from the mountain or washing diapers in a bucket. It was just fun. It was just fun. And it was fun. We had lots of, we had one weekend when, you know, some people came up to celebrate their marriage. And there were 27 people. I'm cooking for 27 people, you know, on a little 12-inch wide stove. It was a 2 feet long by 12-inch wide stove and a hibachi, a good hibachi, not one of these crappy little American ones. And, yeah, okay. Okay, we do that. But I really, you know, I just... I guess it was the cooking. I loved doing all the New Year's cooking and making mochi and making koji. Learning how to make koji to make miso was fabulous, and you know that was really an interesting process. Or figuring out how to make tempeh in a cooler with bottles of hot water to regulate the temperature. It was interesting.
Was there a downside at all?
Downside, yeah, it was a lot of work. And lots of, and some isolation too, you know. And then, you know, if you're out in the woods and you just have your family there, it's like being on a small boat in the middle of the ocean. You know, there's no way out. I mean, go for a walk, you know, we're still gonna come back to the same. If something's like not going so well, you're gonna come back and it's gonna be right there. There's no way to go away. Just good practice. It was all good practice.
What did you do when you came back into town?
I needed to get a job, so I substitute taught for a while. I didn't really want to be a teacher that much, but I was so close to that master's, you know. And then I got a job teaching middle school.
When I met you, you were working at the county library.
Right, so I taught middle school for 10 years, and I retired from that. And then I finished my master's in education, just to... kind of like to say to my kids, see, I can finish these things. And then I went to San Jose State. I did a San Jose State Master's in Library Science online. And then I worked 5 years for the Mendocino County Library System. And kind of worked my way up. First, I was like working part-time extra help. And then I was a library technician for a while. And then I was a reference librarian. And then I ran the Willits Library. And then I managed Ukiah Library. It was a quick ascension, but lots of fun. I really loved that job. I just didn't want to work 5 days a week anymore. So
do you think that the Back to the Land movement has changed the culture of Mendocino County?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, like you said before, that so many people in Ukiah now came from Greenfield Ranch. I mean, that's coming from a different perspective. We didn't raise our kids with... Well, I don't know how anybody else raised their kids. My kids didn't get raised with like private bedrooms and their own bathrooms and their own telephones. It just didn't happen. My kids didn't even have TV. So I don't know. You know, neither one of my kids lives in the country now. My older son had said that, you know, he really would have moved back to Lake County if there'd been any jobs. So I'd have to ask them how that really affected them. I don't know how it would. In Lake County, I don't know there was any effect whatsoever because it was such a small Back to the Land movement there. So Mendocino and Lake, and I'm Lake, so my experience is going to be a little different.
Are you ready to come back to the one about how the experience affected the rest of your life?
I think it gave me a whole lot of joy, in addition to the problems it caused for me. But that was, you know, personal problems. I just loved doing that. That was so much fun. And, you know, I'd love to do it again. I don't think at this point in my life it's not feasible, but it was so much fun. No. Until the last 2 years we lived there, there were no lights on a horizon. And then somebody put up a cell tower so we could see a cell tower. But just the big, big, beautiful skies every night, sitting in that hot water, looking up at the sky. It didn't get much better than that. So it was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. So, yeah, now I'm spoiled. You know, I've got a washing machine. What the heck was that? You know, electricity that goes on, water. It's very easy. Life is very easy. But I don't, on the other hand, I don't need a huge house. I don't need a whole lot of stuff.
and I don't shop. That was partly because we didn't have a whole lot of money when we were up there, so the shopping was kind of out of the question. And now, you know, it's like shopping. I don't know, shopping. Oh, girls just love to shop. I don't think so. Boring.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about that I didn't ask about?
Gosh, I don't know. Yeah, I wish we could have stayed up there. It would have been nice. But, you know, life changes. Stuff happens and you have to follow where it goes. But I heard that the road in, there was one place where it's washed out now, so you can't drive all the way in anymore. And I haven't gone up to see. But I'd like to. Oh, here's an interesting thing. So I don't know, this relates to Maya. This is one thing my kids did. We had a Japanese friend who's a potter, and he built a big Onagama kiln up there. So an Onagama is dug into the mountainside, and my kids helped dig it. Literally, they were part of the digs, and then it's all bricked over. So that was a lot of fun. They came up every month for a long time. They're back in Japan now, but that was a lot of fun. To watch the kids dig.
How long did it take to build this kiln?
Oh, geez, I don't know. Probably close to a year, because they weren't there all the time. They didn't live there. They'd come up for a week or two and then go back. So when they fire it, they'd fire 5 cords of wood. Hardwood, not pine.
Where did you get the wood?
We had 240 acres. So there, you know, and so there's a lot of wood falling down all the time. It wasn't a problem.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. We've been listening to a lightly edited interview with Anne Scirocco as part of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. This program airs on KZYX at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. You can also catch shorter excerpts during the news hour on Thursday mornings at 7:45 and 8:45, and again at 6 p.m. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.